The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 7th of December 2021 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing. We are live from Monocle's headquarters at Dufourstrasse 90 in Zurich. I'm Chris Charmack. Coming up on today's show, leading scientists have warned that Omicron could become the dominant variant of COVID-19 in the coming weeks. We'll have the latest from our health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. Also up ahead, Washington confirms that it will not be sending an official mission to next year's Winter Olympics in China. Here's White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki.
The Biden administration will not send any diplomatic or official representation to the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics and Paralympic Games, given the PRC's ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity in Xinjiang.
Will other nations follow the U.S. lead? After that, we'll bring you the latest business stories, a newspaper review from here in Zurich, and finally, Chiara Ramella is here to deliver her cultural roundup. What have you found for us, Chiara?
Well, we'll be talking about Tikkun Tauting Tragedy, Barbados' new museum, and the falling fortunes of true crime.
Is it a tragedy for ticket touters? That is the question. All that is right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Charmack. Nearly 2 years into this pandemic, it's the uncertainty that seems to come whenever a new variant emerges that really plays on our minds. British and American scientists have now warned that the Omicron variant of coronavirus is likely to outcompete the Delta strain in the coming weeks leading into Christmas, with more than 40 countries now confirming the presence of Omicron since it was first detected by scientists in South Africa. But is this really a cause for concern, or could Omicron be a milder strain that we can actually be less worried about? Let's get the latest on all of this now with Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. Chris is also a consultant virologist at Cambridge University. Chris, always good to have you on the show to sort of help us unpack the latest in the virus and Omicron. As I said at the top, I think it is this wearying uncertainty, the mixed messaging that really impacts people at this stage of the pandemic, especially. What do we know for certain about Omicron?
I was on a television program last week, and hello, Chris, by the way, with Angelique Kwetsi, who is the doctor, primary care physician in South Africa, who first stumbled upon the clinical manifestations of this new variant. And what she noticed about the patients, who were all chiefly young, was that they presented with a bit of a cough, they had a fever and night sweats, were achy and just looked a bit viral. And as South Africa had only a few hundred cases a day of coronavirus at that time, she thought, well, it's rare, but we'll test these people anyway. And by the end of the day, when she'd had about 7 or 8 people with identical symptoms and then got back a positive for coronavirus, she thought, well, this is a bit strange because the symptoms appear to be different to the classical holy trinity of a high temperature, loss of smell and taste, and this persistent cough that won't go away. And that spawned then the pursuit that turned into, right, we've got a new variant on our hands. This prompted many countries around the world to, with a sort of knee-jerk reaction, I think probably accelerated and inflamed by fairly kind of grandiose statements from scientists like, this is the worst mutant we've ever seen, because this is a highly mutated variant. It's got about 50 genetic changes in it, 30 of them in the region of the virus genetic code that it uses to assemble its outer coat, and specifically the spike part of the outer coat that it uses to infect us and which we use to make our vaccines, which is what's got people worried. But this has led to a number of countries closing their borders to South Africa, closing off various flights and so on, enhanced screening for people coming and going from various countries, and now the race is on to detect this in various countries around the world to get some measure of how much it's already spread, but also how fast it's spreading, because that's the interesting thing in South Africa. The few hundred cases per day that they were picking up have now accelerated to tens of thousands, I mean 10, 20,000 cases a day that they know about. Most of them in Gauteng province. And so it does appear to be spreading very fast and going very quickly. But as Angelique Kwetsi says, it's a pretty trivial infection for these people.
So if it is a trivial infection, as you describe it, I guess, what sense do you make of these warnings that Omicron could take over from Delta at some point in the next few weeks? I mean, could that in some ways almost be a good thing if more transmissible doesn't necessarily mean a worse case of the coronavirus?
More spreadable doesn't mean more nasty. And that's the critical thing. They're independent. A virus that makes you really, really ill can make you really, really ill, but spread really badly. I mean, look at bird flu, H5N1, which had a nearly 100% mortality rate, but was dismal in its ability to spread between people. But this new variant appears to spread incredibly well, but produces mild symptoms. So it's not a given, just because something is highly transmissible, that it's also highly pathological. And some people have, in a fairly tantalizing way, speculated that perhaps this is the direction of evolution the virus will take, because this is the sort of virus that we don't mind so much. It's a bit more like the common cold. It doesn't kill people, so you're more likely to tolerate it. We're less likely to erect barriers to stop this thing spreading. So as a result, it reflects a beneficial change for the virus in terms of its ability to persist in the population. And it's a lot better for us, obviously, so we will accommodate it rather than try to stop it. So this is the sort of pattern of evolution that viruses tend to follow. There's host pathogen co-evolution, where there's give and take on both sides, and they arrive at some sort of equilibrium position where neither is too much of a burden on the other. That could be the first step towards this happening. On the other hand, it may just fizzle out, but given the accelerated profile of spread that they're seeing in South Africa, then we may anticipate that we're going to see this in other countries. And so far, more than 30 countries have said now they're looking, they're finding this thing. So in other words, Cyril Ramaphosa, president of South Africa, is quite right when he says, you know, look, you're slamming the door after the horse has bolted by putting in place all these travel restrictions, because this bird's already flown the nest, effectively. It's everywhere. Now it's a question of doing some important epidemiology, establishing how fast is it spreading, where's it going, who's it infecting, and then asking the question, how serious is it for those people? And not just in a South African population, which has a different demography, quite a different age profile, different other risk factors, lack of vaccination, HIV, for example, compared with, say, a country like the UK, very high rates of vaccine use, but at the same time, an older population. We'll have to do that. Plus, we've got to do the sort of test tube wet chemistry experiments where you grow the virus in the laboratory and then you ask, do the antibodies that people make when they're either naturally infected with a prior variant or, probably more likely, have been vaccinated, do those antibodies neutralise this new variant? To what extent do they neutralise it? How much antibody do you need to do that? And then you compare that with what you've got in the population. If it turns out that vaccination plus a couple of boosters pushes people way up over that limit, everyone's laughing. If not, then we're on to plan B.
Well, Chris, quickly there, what you're describing is, I mean, could actually be then good news. Do you have any sense, though, of a timeline? When will we know for certain? When will the first sort of real studies come out that tell us whether this is really what the virus is showing, that it is a milder, a faster spreading but milder virus?
The stock answer that when journalists ask any kind of commentator that question at the moment is, it's too early to tell, it'll be 2 or 3 weeks. This is like the classic scientist answering the question. They say, in the next 5 to 10 years. It's early days. one does not want to put the cart before the horse here. It's very important to do this properly and not to give inflammatory speculation in either direction. We must be cautious, but at the same time not overly concerned people. Myself, I'm not overly concerned based on what we're seeing so far. Time will tell, but within the next 2 or 3 weeks, based on the trajectory of this thing we saw in southern Africa, we will know what the likelihood of this is displacing the current Delta, which is the dominant circulating strain around the world, and pushing it off to one side and taking over, and then what it does in the face of vaccination and different age profiles. Once we've got that data, which we'll get in the next 2 or 3 weeks, I think we'll have a much clearer picture as to where this thing's heading.
Just finally then, quickly, Chris, what does that mean in your mind for the holidays? 2 to 3 weeks, well, at that point we are in Christmas. So what do you advise to people and governments now that they should be doing?
The UK government is saying to people, you should go business as usual, because as Chris Whitty, who's the England Chief Medical Officer, reminded everybody a couple of weeks ago, look, the big threat remains Delta. It's accounting for, in the UK at least, between 40 and 50,000 cases per day that we know about. So if you were comfortable going ahead with your Christmas in the face of that threat, then you certainly shouldn't change your plans over something at the moment, which is certainly at very, very low levels. That will change. It will change quite quickly if it's going to, but it's not a clinical threat and it's certainly not a numbers threat at this stage. So if this does begin to bite and cause a problem, it won't be until early next year when it does. So at this stage, I think the UK government advice to go ahead with your Christmas, but perhaps, you know, minimise the amount of snogging, which was one controversial comment put forward by a minister last week, might be the order of the day.
That was one of the stranger comments of this pandemic. Thanks very much, Chris, for that. That was Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, the United States is preparing for a big week of touting its democratic credentials and antagonizing Beijing in the process. Yesterday, the United States announced a diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympics over China's many human rights violations. And later this week, U.S. President Joe Biden will be hosting a virtual summit for democracy. The summit will not include China, but it will include Taiwan, which of course isn't even a nation in China's eyes. Will any of this have a material impact on relations, and will China retaliate? Well, for more on this, I am joined by David Schlesinger. David served as the editor-in-chief of Reuters and spent a number of years working as the news agency's bureau chief in both Taipei and Beijing. He joins me from our studio in London. Thanks so much for coming in, David, first of all. Let's start with this Olympic boycott announcement from yesterday. I mean, how big a message do you feel this sends, and do you really expect a Chinese response?
Well, it is a message, of course. So why do countries bother hosting an Olympics? They host an Olympics for pride, for prestige, for international attention. And now all of a sudden, there's a bit of a slap in the face. So it is a message. But how important a message? I think not a very big one. It's only a diplomatic boycott, as you said. That means Biden himself won't go, Kamala Harris won't go, the ambassador won't go. But who really cares? Let's think back to the last huge real boycott of the Olympics. That was 1980, when the U.S. led about 60 nations to completely boycott the Soviet Union's Moscow Olympics because Moscow had invaded Afghanistan. Now, did that cause Moscow to withdraw from Afghanistan? Certainly not. Did it have anything to do with the fall of the Soviet Union 11 years later? Certainly not. So, yes, it's a slap, it's a message, but ultimately it has very little real effect.
Little real effect. Speaking of little real effect, perhaps then, I mean, as I mentioned at the top there, the timing of this, you could argue, was maybe on purpose ahead of Joe Biden's summit for democracy, which is also a sort of symbolic shot at Beijing and other autocratic nations. Perhaps also sending a message, though, for allies to follow suit and also boycott the Olympics. Could that be one way it's seen?
Well, it does give cover for other countries to also do a diplomatic boycott. New Zealand, I think, already said that it wouldn't go for COVID-related reasons, which I think would deter a lot of people. Australia may well follow suit because Australia's relations with China are particularly poisonous at the moment. We'll have to see what Germany will do with the new coalition. The new foreign minister, the incoming foreign minister, is from the Green Party, and she has always been very skeptical about China relations. But let's see what the coalition partners will think about. Yes, many places want to send a message to Beijing, but nobody really wants a break with Beijing. Nobody wants to do anything that would cause a huge ruction.
Well, and more broadly then, what is your impression of this summit for democracy of Joe Biden's coming up? I mean, what kind of message will that really send? Is it essentially a talking shop, a sort of show of the power, or at least taking a stand as democracies, although at the same time there's been questions about who is even joining in that sense? What's your impression of the kind of message it can send?
Well, I think the real message of this democracy summit is that Joe Biden is not Donald Trump. So Donald Trump did everything in his power to try to bring the U.S. back, to withdraw from alliances, to not be a major world power. Now, Biden is saying, we are a world power. We like alliances. We want to host meetings. We want to bring people into our tent. But as you say, it's a very strange meeting. If when you have a democracy summit and you include Iraq, Zambia, Angola, Pakistan, and even thinking about Brazil and other places which have had very questionable records on human rights and authoritarianism in recent years, what is it exactly? It is a meeting without the Soviet Union, without Russia. It's a meeting without China. It says the U.S. can host something without these two.
Without those two, and as I mentioned at the top, though, with Taiwan, and that's, of course, another member that is interesting here. Do you see any significance in that? Again, will that prompt any kind of response? I mean, it does feel like, at the very least, it's another signal of kind of a new era of putting Taiwan on an equal footing with China in many ways.
Well, there's already been a response, the usual angry response from Beijing about whenever anyone does anything involving Taiwan. I see this as very much directed at U.S. domestic politics, where at the moment, China, Taiwan is a litmus test. Are you a good person or are you a bad person? It's basically virtue signaling in the Pacific. If you're a good person, you support Taiwan and you talk about Taiwan's democracy and you talk about how terrible it is that China tries to freeze it out of international organizations. If you're a bad person, you say, well, we signed up for China, for Beijing to be the only China a long time ago. The United Nations says it. All of our allies say it. So what are we really talking about here? But it's a virtue signaling, mainly for domestic politics, because at the moment, you can't appear to be soft on China in the United States without getting a lot of criticism.
Just very quickly to follow up on that, David, do you have any sense that maybe that would mean, say, that the next step is recognizing Taiwan in a more formal way?
I don't see that possible. I really don't see that anybody wants to disturb the status quo at the moment, not even Taiwan, not even Beijing, and certainly not the U.S. The U.S. has enough problems at the moment, and with the really big foreign policy issue coming up, which is Russia-Ukraine. Certainly, Joe Biden would not be crazy enough to want to open up a major new rift with China. Makes no sense.
Absolutely. And Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin's meeting is something we'll be following as well. David, thank you very much for that. That was the China expert, David Schlesinger. You are listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24. It is time now for a look at some of the day's newspaper headlines with the journalist and broadcaster, Juliet Linley. Regular listeners will know that Juliet spent many years as a Vatican correspondent, and she joins me now here in the studio in Zurich. Nice to have you here, Juliet.
Nice to have you here, Chris. It's so good to have you in Zurich, too.
It's been a fun few days, I have to say, with the Christmas market, where we did a fair amount of stuff as well over the weekend, and now covering The Briefing as well. So yes, it's good to be here. Let's start with, you are sticking, Juliet, with your Vatican beat to kick us off. Could the Pope be headed to Russia?
Well, there we go. He's just back from his apostolic trip to Cyprus and Greece. And on his return flight, you might remember, Chris, that the Pope always goes to the back of the plane where he meets the media scrum, if you want, all the journalists who are covering his trip. So he boarded his flight from Athens to Rome, goes to the back of the plane, and he delivered what could be a Russian Orthodox bombshell, if you want, in the in-flight press conference. So he told journalists that he would be willing to be the first Pope in history to go to Russia since the Great Schism 1,000 years ago. That was when in Christianity it resulted in the permanent split between the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox churches. So on board the flight, the Pope told journalists he'd be willing to meet the Russian Orthodox Patriarch Kirill in Moscow. And it's something that has never happened. And he even went as far as to say that a top Russian Orthodox Church official is due in Rome in the next weeks for talks to decide timing and location. And Chris, location is actually key, because one analyst I was talking to this morning, he is saying that the meeting could well take place next year, but unlikely in Moscow, more likely in Kazakhstan, at the 2022 Festival of Religions, which was postponed this year due to the pandemic.
Interesting. So he wouldn't necessarily even go to Russia itself. Is that what I'm understanding?
Maybe not initially. Now, this would be so interesting because they only met once before, Patriarch Kirill and the Pope, and that was in 2016. It wasn't in Moscow. It wasn't in Rome. It was in Cuba, neutral territory. And so analysts are saying it's high time for a second meeting. Let's see what happens.
Let's see what happens indeed. Well, next, there is this rather strange Belarus-Poland-like row shaping up between France and Switzerland.
Very strange. So we've got a report from Le Parisien, and their journalists are reporting that a group of Afghan migrants who were stopped at a Paris train station said that they'd arrived from Switzerland thanks to financial support from the Swiss authorities. So we have not corroborated this on the Swiss front, but apparently these 41 Afghans arrived by fast train TGV to Gare de Lyon, at Gare de Lyon from Zurich. And the French authorities took them in and subsequently emerged that they apparently received money from the Swiss to leave the Confederation and go to France. What do you make of that, Chris? Very bizarre.
It is very bizarre, and it's hard to imagine sort of either would they not be caught, or what would Switzerland's real motivation be, as it were, to do that?
Right. So the journalists for Le Parisien are saying that the Swiss migration authorities deny any knowledge of such a case, and they maintain they have no such policy of funding migrants to move on from Swiss soil. Meanwhile, the French Interior Ministry says it is beefing up police checks at its train stations.
Just in case more come along.
Yeah, sad, no?
It is quite sad.
Switzerland is a member of Schengen, and as we know, it's located on one of the key routes preferred by migrants who've escaped Afghanistan, passing through Austria. So I guess we need to investigate further.
We will. I wonder if perhaps it's a private group or there was something else involved. We'll see what comes out of that. It'll be interesting to follow. But finally, just going back to the Pope.
Let's go back to Rome.
Back to Rome. You bring us news of the Vatican's Christmas tree this year.
Yes. So Christmas is coming. The goose is getting fat, and then it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas in St. Peter's Square. So we've got a 30-meter Christmas tree standing tall in the piazza, and it was trucked down from Trentino Alto Adige. Now, this is a tradition started by Pope St. John Paul II back in 1982, and every year the tree is donated from a different, obviously sustainable forest. And this year, you'll be happy to know, in true COP26 spirit, the tree is illuminated by low energy consumption lights, and it's decorated with little wooden spheres, so very eco-friendly. And at its feet, also by tradition, is a nativity scene. Again, every year the papal creches come from a different spot on the planet, and this year it's from the village of Chopka in the Andes. Now, the Chopka are a rural community speaking Quechua. I didn't know this. I looked it up. And this creche marks 200 years of Peruvian independence. Now, you're going to love this. Included in the nativity scene, along with baby Jesus, Mary, Joseph, the ox, the donkey, there are also some local Peruvian animals like alpacas, vicuna, that are a bit like a guanaco, vizcachas, don't know about them, and an Andean condor. Now, I'm checking on your knowledge of Peruvian wildlife, Chris, with that story.
Oh, my. I don't know about that. I'll have to visit to see exactly what a Peruvian Christmas nativity scene looks like.
Rome at Christmas is always nice.
Rome at Christmas is always nice.
Warmer than Zurich.
Absolutely. That is very true. And also always interesting to hear the diplomatic sort of connections that happen around Christmas and the way that the Vatican uses those. Juliet, thank you very much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That was the journalist and broadcaster, Juliet Linley. You are listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24. Next up, we have the day's business headlines with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. thanks for joining us, as always, on the show, Ewan. Let's start with investors are keeping an eye on the possibility of a default by one of the world's biggest property developers.
Hello, Chris. Yes, I haven't got any Peruvian market news for you. Investors' eyes are on China today. The question that's loomed over Evergrande Group: is the world's most indebted developer too big to fail? Well, investors look like they probably have an answer now. A flurry of announcements have sent Evergrande's bonds tumbling to record lows this week. The company and Beijing making clear that the company is set for one of China's biggest ever debt restructurings. The government is not going to bail it out. Now, barring a last-minute shock, holders of $19 billion of dollar bonds in Evergrande are going to see haircuts as the company overhauls its massive balance sheet. Now, the ratings companies have yet to declare an official default, but holders of those two bonds haven't received an overdue coupon payment, which is due by the end of the 30-day grace period, which finished yesterday. It looks like the beginning of the end for the sprawling real estate empire, which has been started 25 years ago. The company, we understand, is planning to include all of its offshore public bonds and private debt obligations in its restructuring. The company has more than $300 billion of total liabilities. It was really a development mammoth in China, but the company has been struggling to pay its debts. This has been an ongoing saga for some months now, and it really becomes the latest victim of President Xi's efforts to crack down on the freewheeling real estate sector. The Chinese real estate sector has been a source of a lot of growth for China, but it's also been a source of a lot of financial exuberance and a lot of over-indebtedness. So it looks like this saga is starting to come to an end.
Well, we're keeping an eye on that. A lot of financial exuberance, as you say, and just so many buildings that have popped up in China. But let's move on to one other story before you go. A big change for residents of the UAE from next year.
Yeah, Chris, from January the 1st, the United Arab Emirates is to move its weekend to Saturday and Sunday. Now, it's the first Gulf nation to shift from Friday and Saturday. Friday, of course, is a holy day in Islam. The plans are going to come in pretty soon, really, 3.5 weeks' time. Not much notice to fix your weekend plans. The Gulf state says it can adopt a 4.5-day working week. Sounds rather nice, doesn't it? The half day on Friday means people finish working at midday. Interesting to see what the rest of the Gulf nations do, including Saudi Arabia. The two countries have really been vying for a lot of business recently. They all have their Sunday to Thursday working week. Interestingly, you remember it's only 15 or 20 years since the Gulf shifted their weekend. It used to be Thursday and Friday, and then shifted it to Friday and Saturday. And now the UAE is completing its transition to align with much of the rest of the world, or pretty much the rest of the world, with Saturday and Sunday. Now, for the moment, this just applies to government workers. This is just for the public sector. The government, one government minister in an interview said that the private sector will have flexibility to decide the weekend. We also don't know what's going to happen to the school week in the UAE. But you do wonder, it seems unlikely that the private sector and the public sector are going to have different weekends. That would seem to be rather chaotic. But anyway, fascinating change in the Gulf today.
That is fascinating, and it would be strange, wouldn't it, to have two different situations. But interesting compromise, too, to have a half day on the Friday. We could certainly all enjoy that. Ewan, thanks very much. That was Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. All right, and finally on today's packed show, it is time for a roundup of the week's cultural stories with Monocle's own culture editor, Chiara Rimella. She joins me from the studio in London. Chiara, I'm sorry we're in different locations for this time, but it's good to have you on. And you bring us first with news of a crackdown on ticket touts that we sold at the top.
Indeed. Well, we're heading to Italy for this. Of course, I'll bring you a bit of Italian news. I can't help it.
We just can't help it. Exactly.
Exactly. So this is about the ticket touting that goes on at the Uffizi or the Galleria dell'Accademia. These are obviously very, very popular museums, and historically they've had plenty of problems with ticket touts who would buy tickets in bulk and then resell them at tourists for outrageous prices. And now the museums are trying to bring in new regulations to avoid them making a comeback, now that tourists are also making a comeback to the city. You know, for so many months and months. We've been worrying about the future of museums, thinking that there weren't enough visitors. And I guess you can see this as a bit of a clear sign of a return to normal, that touts are kind of making their appearance back in the courtyard of these museums.
Sort of a return to normal, but then also museums seeking a fresh start, is that fair to say, on how they manage their business?
Absolutely. I think that this has been a time to rethink. I mean, there had been certain initiatives to combat this kind of phenomenon. In the past, you would have, for example, they used to distribute fans for people in the queue, which had the actual official ticket price printed on the fan so that you could see how much of a difference of a price it would be. So this kind of initiatives. The city of Florence had banned selling tourist kind of attraction tickets on public soil, but then again, the touts used to find loopholes in this and rent private space to then be able to sell the tickets anyway. So it's been like a real struggle trying to find ways to avoid the touts finding loopholes. But now it looks like there will be a regulation bringing in named tickets, meaning that you wouldn't be able to dissociate the booking from the person. And this already happens for sport events and concerts for more than 5,000 people in Italy. We'll see if it works.
It seems like a way that would work a lot better than what they have now. It'd be interesting to follow. But let's head over to Barbados. Our listeners, I'm sure, will know that Barbados has cut ties with the British monarchy, but they have made their first sort of cultural statement of separation, if you like.
Absolutely. I think that it's very important how this cultural announcement really makes a statement on the intentions. They have announced that there will be a new museum dedicated to slavery, to the history of slavery, which will be designed by the architect David Adjaye. And I think it's very interesting. The work is scheduled to start on the 30th of November 2022, so to marking the anniversary of this newly formed republic. And it's going to be a museum as well as an archive, a huge archive actually. It's going to be the biggest institution of this sort in the Caribbean, and a historical archive with tens of millions of documents on, and it's going to be a real resource in terms of reshaping the history around slavery and creating a space that will be very symbolic in the newly formed republic, but also a huge resource for the whole Caribbean and the whole world, really.
It's very interesting. Also, just you imagine this wouldn't have been something that was held up by the British monarchy, but nevertheless, the fact that they made this announcement now is quite significant.
Definitely. I mean, that the announcement was made so close to the announcement of the newly formed republic does tell you a bit of like a new course of action, really a way of rewriting history, creating a new narrative and really making a real point about the past.
Well, and just finally, Chiara, you bring us news that apparently we don't really like true crime anymore. Is that true?
Well, I don't know. I've never been a huge fan personally, so I don't know if I'm the best person to talk about this. But my partner really is, so I've kind of been subjected to watching a lot of this. I don't know if you've enjoyed it very much, but anyway,
I've been subjected by my family as well, I have to say. Not so much myself personally.
Well, there you go. But Netflix has been dropping new true crime new crime series pretty much every month in the past year, and at first they were hugely successful. I don't know if you remember The Night Stalker or The Crime Scene at the Cecil Hotel. They were really successful and they managed to stay in the top 10 for more than 14 days. But ever since then, all the new true crime series have really struggled to break that kind of barrier and at least stay up there for such a long time. Apart from Tiger King, of course, that was 2020 and that was a huge, huge success. And now the question that analysts are asking, is it because the true crime is kind of losing its appeal, or is it because other things are becoming more appealing? The argument that Variety makes is that it's actually because, or perhaps it is because, a slate of kind of scripted drama is actually coming to the fore after being halted for so long during the pandemic, that now people are kind of gravitating a bit more towards kind of really groundbreaking scripted drama and not feeling the need so much for the true crime that can filled their long evenings during the pandemic.
Maybe true crime was our escape during the pandemic in some
Everybody likes
strange
it, yeah.
way as well.
Everybody likes their own kind of escapism.
Absolutely. Well, thanks very much, Chiara. Appreciate that. As always, that was Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Mella. And that is all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle in London and Julia Klavans here in Zurich. Our researcher today was Lillian Fawcett and our studio manager was Christy Evans. The Briefing is back tomorrow here in Zurich at the same time, but the Monocle Daily team will be here with a roundup of the day's stories at 1800 London time. I'm Chris Chermak, goodbye, and thanks for listening.